fifth case for this morning. Like our sixth case, involves Mr. Areola. This is Areola v. Chowdhury, number 072696. Mr. Tulson?
Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Carl Tulson, and I am here today representing Mr. Gilbert Areola regarding the denial of his motion for a new trial. Mr. Areola did not receive a fair trial because a partial juror served as a jury foreperson. We raised three arguments in our brief for why this Court must grant Mr. Areola a new trial. I will begin my arguments with the fact that Mr. Areola was denied procedural due process at his post-trial proceeding. Mr. Areola was denied procedural due process at the post-trial proceeding. After reviewing the motion for the new trial, the District Court properly ordered a post-trial evidentiary hearing.
Now, let me stop you right there, because it seems to me there might be at least two ways we could characterize what Judge Cannelli does after it's brought to his attention that there may be a problem. One of them is the way that you have portrayed it in your brief, which is that when he learns there's a problem, he decides that an evidentiary hearing is necessary and he conducts this telephone call with the court reporter. But the other possibility, which it seems to me is in keeping with some things he says, is that he recognizes, number one, that he needs to be careful in terms of what he does with jurors after a trial. He says at one point, I don't want to do anything that will discourage people from serving on juries. And he is, in a sense, making a preliminary inquiry to see if an evidentiary hearing is really called for. And so another way, it seems to me, of characterizing that telephone call might be as that preliminary inquiry. So how am I supposed to know what it is he's doing? Because if it's a preliminary inquiry, then a lot of these arguments from Matthews against Eldridge you're making, I think, don't come into play.
Yes, Your Honor. I would make two points in response to that question. The first is that the other side does not dispute that this was intended to be an evidentiary hearing. And in fact, they concede that the proper remedy would be a remand for an
evidentiary hearing. Characterization by the other side is not significant.
Yes, Your Honor, and that brings me to my second point, which is that under Smith versus Phillips, the Supreme Court, in the majority opinion, has stated that the clear remedy for allegations of juror bias is a hearing at which the defendant has the opportunity to prove actual bias. So at the point at which the district court decided that further inquiry into the allegations was merited based on the two affidavits that were submitted with a motion for a new trial, the proper forum for that to take place is at an evidentiary hearing.
But I think what the judge is, at least when I read the transcript of the telephone conversation, it looks like the judge is trying to get a sense of whether juror number 20, if that's what we're going to call her, in fact misrepresented something in response to the 19th question, or whether there was some other explanation. So if, for example, during that telephone conversation she had said, well, yes, you know, I did break my ankle in the past, that's just a flat contradiction to the question. Instead, what she says is, well, what does severe mean? And he says, oh, that's a good question. And so they go back and forth about, well, you know, she could still go to work. She went on her, you know, vacation. She went on all the tours, as she put it. And the judge, I think, finally decides that there's enough mushiness to the word severe that she didn't misrepresent anything. So I'm not sure he got to the point of thinking that there was a prima facie showing of bias.
Well, Your Honor, the first point I would make is that anytime we don't believe that this court should adopt a rule that anytime an adjective is used in a jury instruction, in a voir dire question, that renders the entire matter so subjective that we need an actual intent to mislead, to find juror bias. And the second point is that the inquiry that took place over the telephone conference lacked all the hallmarks of due process. The witness was not sworn in. And there are additional factual questions that were submitted by Attorney Collison to the judge, which the judge refused to ask the juror. And just because the juror went on vacation afterwards, you know, we have no idea. Did she go on vacation in a wheelchair? Was she on a stretcher? The fact that she was able to go on a boat cruise does not say anything regarding the severity of her ankle injury. And so we believe that it's entirely possible that actual bias would have been shown because she could have suffered a very severe ankle injury. And unlike the other jurors who were challenged for cause, whose challenges were later withdrawn, She is the only juror who sat on the panel who suffered personally a recent and severe ankle injury.
There wasn't any juror who was successfully challenged for cause who had any type of ankle problem in this case, right?
Your Honor, the jurors that were that's correct. We did not successfully challenge. However, certain challenges were withdrawn, and those are obviously, as this Court is aware, can be for procedural or for strategic reasons rather than because the juror was not actually biased. However, the circumstances regarding what we do know about juror number 20 indicates that she would have been biased, whereas other jurors would not have been biased.
What is there possibly to indicate she would have been biased?
Well, in the affidavit that Attorney Carlson submitted based on the interview that was conducted after the trial, juror 20 stated that she was able to know that the treatment that Dr. Chowdhury provided to Mr. Areola was proper because that's what her doctor had done, and so she knew that when the ankle was pressed on, that it couldn't have been a broken ankle because of the tenderness. And so she was bringing in her own personal experience to judge rather than the expert testimony provided to judge the facts.
All jurors bring in personal experiences into a jury.
Matter of fact, we instruct them to do so. You're not to set aside your own experiences in the common affairs of life. That's one of the things we tell the jurors when we swear them in.
Yes, Your Honor. Jurors certainly are allowed to bring in their own personal experience. However, when they're judging the case based on a factual situation they've experienced.
They're not judging it. They're just offering their opinion. Other jurors are talking, and so eventually they come to some consensus about it.
Well, Your Honor, the sole issue...
You want to supervise what goes on in the jury when we have very strict rules that want to prohibit that sort of thing. We don't want to know what goes on in a jury room generally.
It's like making sausages. You don't want to know that either.
That's true, Your Honor. However, with respect to the statement that Juror 20 made, that she knows that Juror 21 told Juror 20 about the treatment of the ankle injury, we don't even know if that took place within jury deliberations. And that is something that had we received an adequate hearing, evidentiary hearing, we would have been able to determine when that statement was made, because it could be that is entirely discoverable and entirely admissible as evidence.
But I want to get back to one of the points Judge Evans made, because even if we thought that we knew all of these things and we were applying the McDonough standard, what the Supreme Court has said very clearly is that once you're in this post-trial period of time, you have to show that somebody would have been excused for cause before there's a problem. You can't just say, well, I might have thought of exercising a peremptory challenge against Juror 20 or juror anybody else. And even if she had said, I had a severe sprain of my ankle or a bad sprain of my ankle or anything like that, on this record, it's hard to see that the court would have dismissed her for cause.
I agree completely, Your Honor. And our contention...
Donna, even if you'd had your evidentiary hearing and had shown that she absolutely misrepresented the question in number 19...
Well, Your Honor, I think that's precisely the problem here, is that requires us to engage in a counterfactual inquiry. There was not an adequate hearing. The witnesses were not sworn in. They were not allowed to cross-examine or call other witnesses. Parties were not allowed to call witnesses, and there was no time for attorneys to speak, and so we don't know what the record would have been. And furthermore, as to the second prong of McDonough, all that is required is to show that a correct response would have provided a valid challenge for cause, and that we did not have the opportunity at the hearing to demonstrate that. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, that's fine. Mr. Unrath.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Craig Unrath, and I represent Dr. Chowdhury. At the very outset, I'd like to take issue with a statement counsel made that no one on the jury personally suffered an ankle injury. I just confirmed this as I was sitting at counsel table there just to make doubly sure that I'm correct. There were two jurors on this panel, sitting on this panel, Juror Crowley and Juror Rosenbaum. Juror Crowley suffered a broken ankle, and Juror Rosenbaum suffered numerous sprained ankles. So to the extent that no one on this jury themselves had suffered an injury, that is, I'm afraid, an inadvertent misrepresentation on the part of opposing counsel. The court had also brought into up the possibility that this was just a preliminary investigation. Now, this is not something I argued in the brief, but what I do know is this, is that the court's order does not say, I decided to hold an evidentiary hearing. What he said is specific language is, I decided to undertake further inquiry, which may, in fact, be similar to your suggestion that it was just a preliminary inquiry. The law I did cite on this issue is this, is that when deciding a motion for a new trial based on allegations of juror misconduct, a trial court has wide discretion. In other words, the court was under no compulsion to hold any type of hearing on this. He has wide discretion as to how he wants to deal with this situation, and under the law, his response to such a motion must be guided by the content of the allegations, the seriousness and likelihood of the alleged bias, and the credibility of the source.
Let me ask you a question, though. Suppose there had been, or suppose even this inquiry that the court had made, as I was hypothesizing earlier, had revealed that juror number 20 had just out and out lied on the answer to question 19. Question 19, have you ever broken your ankle? Answer, no. And in fact, she broke her ankle, you know, 3 years earlier. Just something that anyone could see was a lie. Is the fact of lying alone enough to justify granting a motion to dismiss for cause?
No, and not at all, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, a new trial, it really only satisfies the first prong of the McDonough test. The McDonough test requires that a new trial where a juror failed to answer honestly a material question. My point would be this. It was not a material question. 6 out of the 12 jurors on this panel had sprained or broken ankles. What difference does it make that she had one as well? It would also be McDonough is still not satisfied. There is a third prong to the test. Third prong is that had she given a correct answer, that we would have had a valid challenge for cause. Now, I can just imagine a challenge for cause going up against this particular juror. The judge, knowing the testimony of all the jurors on the panel, would say, well, you have 6 other jurors sitting on this panel right now. You've made no attempt to challenge any of them for cause except for one. And in that one case, actually there were 2. One was in the juror pool. And in those 2 cases, the judge turned to those jurors and said, do you think you can be impartial? And they said, yeah. Challenge for cause was withdrawn in both cases. In other words, there was no attempt to look into this. There was no attempt to investigate it. The fact is that this was not material to plaintiff's counsel. They didn't care. Indeed, in their the proposed question that they submitted, they didn't even ask about sprained ankles. They wanted the court to ask whether anyone had a broken ankle. It was the court that threw in the language about sprained ankles. So I believe that even had that telephone conversation established an outright lie, the fact remains is that, number one, it was not a material question, at least not treated as such by plaintiff's counsel, and two, it would not have led to a valid challenge for cause. Now, this is what I thought was actually quite interesting about this, because, in a way, taken in isolation, yes, it would generate a valid challenge for cause, but it's only when you look at the circumstances as a whole that it becomes apparent that this challenge would never have been granted. Now, in a very recent case, the Warner case, this court held that a valid challenge for cause is not established under circumstances where it is unlikely that the district court would have granted it. So I would say, yes, we may have had a valid challenge of cause created in theory, but one that the court would almost certainly have denied. In terms of her statements actually made during the informal hearing, she said yes, she said no, she said I forgot. It reminds me of some of the political debates that are going on right now, and quite frankly, I don't believe that language has to be parsed any further than this. She had an ankle injury. It didn't cause her to miss work. She described it as it hurt, but it was still functioning. Now, I don't care who you are, you cannot characterize that statement as a dishonest response to the question, have you ever suffered a severe ankle injury? So quite frankly, I believe that they've missed all three portions of the McDonough test. Finally, even when juror bias is shown, this does not mean that a court must order a new trial. Not, as this court had put it, not every incident requires a new trial. Due process does not require a new trial every time a juror has been placed in a potentially uncompromising position. I look at this case, I look at a jury that is filled with people, unexamined people, who have had severe broken ankles or repeatedly sprained ankles, that were put on this jury without objection, and I have to ask myself, how could, even if we presume that error exists, does that error deserve a new trial? And I would submit that it does not. If there are any further questions from the court, we urge you to affirm the trial court's ruling. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Unrath. Anything further, Mr. Tilson?
I'd like to make a few points on in regards to the record and then also to talk about McDonough. First, counsel said that there were two other jurors with broken ankles who were not challenged for cause. However, again, juror number 20 was the only juror who suffered a recent and severe ankle injury. If somebody broke their ankle 5 years ago, that was not something that raised the same level of concern. Secondly, as to whether this was a hearing, the judge below said, you know, when the court scheduled the briefing, he said, if I decide to hold a hearing, we will do it directly after the status, and we will contact the witnesses by telephone. So it is clear that the judge did intend this to be a hearing. Secondly, as to the McDonough test, there's two prongs to the McDonough test, not three, that I'm aware of. And the first prong is that a juror failed to honestly answer a material question, and then two, further show that a correct response would have provided a valid basis for a challenge for cause.
It's the second part of that that worries me about your point.
I'm worried about the first part.
Well, maybe the first two, but
I address them both, or
please.
Well, you got about 10 seconds.
Yeah. Okay. As a threshold matter, it is a material question as to, because the central issue for the trial was whether Dr. Chowdhury's treatment of Mr. Earle's ankle injury constituted deliberate indifference. And I would distinguish the Warner case, in which the alleged juror misconduct in that case was a law journal article brought into the jury room. That's completely different than something that goes that's material to the central question the juror has decided is the juror needs to decide. And as to the second prong of McDonough, McDonough does not require a counterfactual inquiry into whether the attorney would have challenged for cause or whether the court would have granted a challenge for cause. I think it's clear from the affidavits that this was something that sufficiently raised the district court's concern, such a hearing was ordered but not held. And therefore, because the hearing was not held in accordance with due process, as in Vasquez-Ruiz, an inadequate inquiry into alleged juror misconduct requires a new trial.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. And you were appointed, were you not, or
yes,
recruited, or whatever we should say. We appreciate very much your assistance to the court and to your client.